This episode of Bedroom Beethovens is brought to you by Nirvana CBD, one of the fastest growing CBD brands in the space. We dive deep into some pretty crazy conversations on this podcast. Stress gets high. It's only human nature. So naturally, we need some products that promote relaxation. Or maybe you're looking for a delicious way to enhance your wellness routine. And I get it. There are a lot of CBD products on the market, but I invite you to experience the Nirvana CBD difference. Featuring a wide selection of ultra-premium lab-tested CBD products, including CBD oils, topicals, gummies, and soft gels. They got everything you need that's packed with natural components, and they even have products for your dog, furry friend. You know, if they have a hard time calming down or relaxing, or maybe they get riled up by New Year's Eve fireworks, whatever it is, they got you covered, and you don't have to worry about any wonky ingredients because it's made from human-grade organic ingredients, meaning these bestie bites offer pets a delicious way to enjoy broad-spectrum CBD. So whether it's for yourself or your furry friend, head on over to nirvanacbd.com and get free shipping on all orders over $50. That website, again, is nirvanacbd.com.
The greatest thing to me that I love is hearing the way that you honor the artist that you have on.
Stories make the world go round. They capture our minds, pull at our hearts, and inspire change, growth, and development.
It's just your genuine human appreciation on a deep, like, soul level for what artists do. This, your podcast is really dope.
I'm your host, Cello, and welcome to Bedroom Beethovens, the podcast where we discover some of the preeminent music producers and entertainers of our time, and I turn them into storytellers.
What's up? This is J-Rock, and I'm right here. I'm chilling on the Bedroom Beethovens podcast. That's what it is. Let's go.
Welcome, people of Earth. Episode 175 is here. My guest this week is...
My name's Jasper Patterson. I'm probably better known as Ground as Lava on the in the world of music and the internet and whatever. Yeah, I've been doing music, electronic music. Affiliations are I co-founded a record label called We Did It with Shlomo and Nick Mellon and you know, some of our like people from early on that were part of the crew are like Arl Grime and Ryan Hemsworth, who you mentioned you had on here before, and
aka one half of Landlord.
So that's like pre-Ground is Lava. I'm surprised you know about that.
Really cool episode that takes me back to the West Coast. Jasper, aka Ground is Lava, invites me into his mind as a 30-something creative who comes from an equally impressive family of creatives, and we see what makes him tick. You know the drill. It's a format you've come to know and love. But a message that bears repeating is that, you know, this show, you might have noticed a little ad at the top of the show, and I thank my sponsors, and it must be done, because this is a small labor of love. And to keep the lights on, we gotta have them. And they're awesome. But what you can do is join the little community I have over at patreon.com/bedroombeethovens. Throw a buck or two or five or ten, and I'll throw early episodes your way. And you can send music into the show or just talk to me. Anything you want. You give a little, you get a little. It's a nice workout plan. Make sure you follow on all of the socials. And as we wind down for the year, I know I've been slacking. Episodes are a little bit more sporadic, but I've pumped over 1,000 minutes of new content into the feed this year, and I appreciate it if you've listened to just one of those minutes. And you could be anywhere else in the world, but you're here with me now. I'm Cello, episode 175, with the great and powerful Ground is Lava.
the red Ground is Lava album originally was a Landlord album, and it was not as much solo music. And then Jake's acting career like really started to take off, and he just didn't have as much time as I did to do music stuff. And yeah, I kind of just like dropped out of college at that point and made it into a solo record. And then, yeah.
I don't really know I don't really know Jake on paper, but like his mom was in soaps and then he's acting in soaps. So that's a smart way into the business, which from there, he's, like you say, he's been in movies and network television. He didn't necessarily move to LA with a dollar and a dream, you know, being in LA your whole life with your dad's ties in the music field. Did that kind of grease the wheels at all in your start in a similar way? You know, because I know the struggle of passing out College for Dogs CDRs at Low End Theory, but I wasn't sure if the strength of your hustle was because you wanted to be as independent as possible.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I think part of like what was interesting with working with Jake and what kind of like made my music stuff more serious was that me and Jake met at CalArts, and Jake's vibe was like totally East Coast. He's from Jersey, and like we were very different people, but we just vibed out as like just friends. And like he was my first buddy at CalArts, and we actually both ended up leaving after our first year. But I think just working with someone who was like totally different from me, and he was doing vocals, and it just kind of like took the music out of just being this really bedroom kind of like just for me and my friends thing, and made me realize it could be more than that. Yeah. I mean, obviously, you know, I grew up in that house of artists. You mentioned my dad, he animated the Aha Take on Me video, a duo with my mom. They were directing music videos together, and me and my brother grew up, you know, I was in college actually for visual arts. I wasn't studying music. Although I was making music and was probably still more interested in music at the time. But yeah, I mean, it was always kind of in my head as like there wasn't really another option for me growing up. Not that I was not encouraged to do other things. I just, from day one, it was like always my focus was, it's one of my big sort of, I don't want to say regrets, but like things I stress over in life was that I really let go of my visual art practice a lot when my music stuff took off.
Yeah, you mentioned your dad. I think there's something that it gets talked about. You're probably tired of hearing it, but I think more people actually need to know is he's responsible for the Scat Cat, MC Scat Cat, that cat that dances with Paula Abdul. He didn't just animate it, but that's like his idea. He created that. He directed the video.
The Aha video was like my dad drew every frame of that. That was like his art style, that whole animation technique. Like he's 100% responsible for that. And he drew every frame, you know, but the Sky Cat video, he was working much more of a director role. And I think that like, in terms of the, you know, he wasn't like character animating that, the same way he was in the Aha video, but he very much directed that video that both my parents did. And my dad did draw all the soup, like in those scenes where they're dancing on the steps. And there's like the crazy 80s pattern backgrounds. Like he drew all those frames and those backgrounds and stuff. I see pictures of my dad from the time. And he wore like all – that was like his look back then was like he always wore like high top chucks and like tank tops, like and big jeans, you know. And it's just funny. Like my dad always jokes like, oh, that was like – I looked like Scat Cat back then.
People forget that Opposites Attract failed to chart. The song was a failure. So professionally speaking, it might not have done your dad any favors for his resume at the time. But out of everyone, I think he was the only winner because he actually got a Grammy Award for that.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like, it's funny. Like, I think growing up until high school, I was way more aware of Scat Cat than I was of the Aha video. Like, I don't really remember knowing about the Aha video until I was like an early teenager. Even though that now is like, it's had this like massive new life with the Weezer cover and just kind of like
Family Guy had that clip, remember? Yeah.
But the craziest thing was that I always remember when they did that gag on Family Guy, I was, and my dad coming in the room and being like, oh shit, like they're doing a bit about my, you know, video. And he was kind of like, just, he was like, whoa, this is crazy. And then I remember at some point, like a couple years later, I was at their house again over a holiday or something, and I'm watching, and they did the same bit with the Paula Abdul video. And my dad was like, what the fuck? He was like, not mad. He was just like, there must be like a fan or something. Cause you know, there's a lot of people who like show love to my dad, but like, you know, he's a little more behind the scenes, you know, like when people think of those videos, they think of the artists more than the animators and the directors and stuff. So to have two of his videos singled out for a repeat Family Guy gag was like a really hilarious thing.
So you're in visual arts, you move to music. That brings me to like two questions, because was that a shot to the heart to your dad? But also now you don't have to kind of like live in a shadow. Like if you don't get a Grammy, if you get a Grammy now, it'll be for a completely different lane. It won't be for like animation and visual arts. So maybe that was a relief. How was that transition?
It definitely wasn't a shot in the heart or anything like that. But I think, and also like me and my brother's drawing style and art was very similar. And my brother always had a little more of a knack for it than I did. I mean, we differed, but like he's a really, I don't know if you've seen his stuff. He does the brand Sus Boy, and I always kind of felt like I was playing catch up to my brother in terms of like my drawing abilities, especially because we love drawing a lot of the same kind of like sci-fi, like monsters and like, you know, just we very much were in the same lane. And also my parents just, they didn't see my visual art practice as like a lineage legacy. Like there was never any expectation of that. Like if I had, you know, come out of school wanting to go into like, I was going to say dentistry, but of course every parent would want their kid to go into medicine, but whatever it was, you know what I mean? They would have been supportive of it. But at the same time, I will say that there was a certain element of having a creative career and not following, like when I stopped working, you know, I had random jobs. I've had lots of random jobs on the side as an artist. And during the times when I've just been relying on freelance work and, you know, there is, especially when I was younger, like these moments of like, my whole family is really tuned into working as a visual artist and in the visual arts and film. And that's what my brother does too. And when I've come up against points in my life where I'm like, I don't know what to do next as a professional in the arts, I don't have the same wealth of knowledge to tap into with my folks that my brother does working in visual stuff. When I did switch to music, there was a bit of like, I'm going off on my own journey from the rest of the family.
You know what? It's a strong start though, because you mentioned Cal Arts, and if people don't know Cal Arts, I mean, everyone from the creator of SpongeBob to Pee Wee Herman to David Hasselhoff went there.
Like, the reason I left Cal Arts was because they didn't really offer any technical courses in drawing, because they were just so like about not being about, you know, who's got the best technique and this and that. They're really about concept and sort of thinking about art, and which is great. But for me, I went there wanting to like hone my craft as someone who's, you know, spent half of every day like with my nose in a sketchbook. And I couldn't find that there, but I did, just being surrounded by the arts always, I just found myself, I think, just thinking about art making. And I spent so much of my free time making music when I was there. Probably more time than I did animating. And I think it was a really great experience. And I actually, when I left there, I went to USC for a year and a half in just fine arts, not in animation. And they had the more technical courses there, but the environment was way more conservative. And it was kind of like the things that I wanted at CalArts but didn't have, I found there. But I lost the sort of
environment that felt more, I don't know, like the intangible part of it that I liked at CalArts, I lost. So, yeah.
What's funny, though, is like for every 100 applicants to CalArts, only 20 are admitted. So if you apply to the school, you only have a 1 in 5 shot to get in. So when you decide to drop out, people don't understand. It's a weighty decision. It's not a knee-jerk decision.
I applied to two majors at CalArts. I applied to music tech and to experimental animation. And that was two full separate applications, two whatever application essays. And they did not accept me to the music program. And they did accept me to the animation program. I think that was the program my dad was in, was experimental animation there as a graduate student. And so they probably were like, yeah, let's stick him in here. That's where his dad was in. But I remember being really bummed at the time I didn't make it into music, because even though art was like, I felt like was everything for me, visual art, music was something where like I really was finding myself. It was this thing I had like really felt like I had found myself a lot as an artist at the end of high school in this thing that was really new for me, which was making music, versus even though drawing was like this thing I did since day one and was comfortable doing, I always felt like I was like so far from where I wanted to be in drawing, and the element of like showing people my work always felt like, you know, being like, hey, you want to look at my sketchbook, versus like playing music for someone and seeing that kind of like immediate tangible response where you can like see them hearing it and like you can see them have a physical reaction to it. There was just something really, I don't know, yeah, like I said before, like liberating as an artist and as someone who expresses himself creatively.
So when you first went public with your moniker, were people really calling you Bratislava?
It's never stopped being confusing for people. It's something I hated for years, but then over time I'm just like, this is the most like uniquely Googleable thing, and I'm just totally fine with it.
Is another point of annoyance being referred to as a chiptune producer, or have you kind of softened on that stance?
I very much softened on that. I think that back then the scene was small. And so everyone was kind of, that was like the early LA beat scene in quotes days, like whatever. I mean, clearly you know about that because you were mentioning Low End and my early EPs, but you know, I'm sure for a lot of people, especially younger people, they have no idea what I'm talking about. But that era around, you know, making Dilla beats and like Fly Low and Brain Feeder and like early We Did It stuff. And everyone was kind of making the same, not the same, but we were all working within the confines of this like genre or subgenre of wonky kind of glitchy instrumental hip hop. It felt a lot worse being shoehorned into this chiptune thing during that time, because it was such a, I don't know. Over time, I became more into it because all these scenes kind of blended together, and I felt like it, you know, as someone who I make music that's pretty hard to put into a box, to have some kind of tag that people can call back what I do with, or like some point of reference is nice. Because if a random person asks me about my music now, like what kind of music I make, I don't know where to start. Versus, you know, at that point in time, it was like, what kind of beats do you make? And it was like, some guys made beats like this, and some guys made like 8-bit beats. And I didn't want to be like just 8-bit beat.
Well, it's funny though, because you mentioned that, you know, if you go up to like a 17-year-old beat maker and you mention the LA beat scene, like you just said, no one's going to know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
And what's really crazy is if you look on those flyers back then, You're not going to see just Daedalus and DiBiase. You're going to see Schoolboy Q, Riff Raff, Tory Lanez, Pusha T, Freddie Gibbs.
Yeah.
People that had like no business, maybe. I don't know, being on that. It just seems kind of like an identity crisis. But there were some huge, huge names on those flyers.
Yeah, dude. I mean, like, we did it, put out the first Tory Lanez EP. And, you know, we Friends of Friends did. We brought out Pusha T at an event. You know, we did an event with Paul Wall. We did it. I mean, this is a little later, but like we did stuff with Lil Yachty, and like we brought out. I remember one year we did a showcase at South by Southwest, and we brought out as special guests Post Malone and Tory Lanez.
That's crazy.
Oh my god! And it's like, thinking back now, it's like, dude, at the time, no one knew who the fuck Post Malone was, you know, but it was pretty, looking back, it's like, what the fuck?
Oh, I got something that'll trip you out too, is it kind of goes full circle, because speaking of Freddie Gibbs, he's on a show that's streaming on Peacock called Bust Down, and I think you need to sue someone, because you're the original Bust Down. So kind of a crazy coincidence.
Okay, I was like, are you talking about, okay, there's a couple of things, but yeah, that was like a really... That's so random. That guy, I actually, we're still good buddies. But that was a film that I scored, although I don't think my music was used in the final version for whatever reason. But that was very much the product of a early Kickstarter era kind of creative process of like something that was like changing and growing as this Kickstarter kind of like gained following, and there was money and stuff. But yeah, it was a short film I scored, and yeah, I can't remember where that actually went, but that's so funny you bring that up. That must have been a bit of a dig to find that one.
Everyone knows you're on the Streets of Rage 4 soundtrack, but what I was curious is Yuzo Koshiro was on that as well, like the OG. Was there any overlap? Were you able to communicate? Were they be like, hey, that track was awesome?
No, I wish. The one thing I was hoping for with that project was that, like, a little bit of like, even just to like know that maybe he heard my track or something. I'm guessing he's heard it, but the music supervision team that did that game was awesome, and it was great working with them, and but yeah, it was very much like at least my part of it. I worked on music, and I just sent it through them, and I didn't really get to interface with those guys at all, like the devs too much. I mean, I interfaced indirectly with the devs, but not with like the kind of legendary other music people that were involved.
So I think if you have the opportunity, like, I think it was like a really cool bucket list thing, but I think if you wanted to have another crack at it, you would probably want to compose the whole score. Like, you know, like Supreme Commander and Total Annihilation, there's that one guy and he has that signature sound, you know? So instead of just doing like one track on a one-off, you can kind of create the feel and be a part of the legacy.
Definitely. Those are, that's a good reference too. I actually just recently found a vintage Total Annihilation shirt on Etsy that I ordered, and it came from Thailand, and it didn't show up. I thought it was never going to show up, but it actually showed up in the mail like a year later, and it's my favorite shirt now. Yeah, that would be definitely, that was my one thing with the game, was like only getting to do one song. I don't want to say I was bummed out, because I was so stoked to be on the thing, but I was like, I would have loved to do more on that game and get to like show more of myself. But that being said, the fact that my music plays during the first boss is like, that's pretty hard to beat in terms of, you know, when if you're going to have one song in the game, I'd say like title screen or first boss would be
best. You always remember the first boss. Final Fantasy VII, I still remember the first boss, that little scorpion boss. Everybody remembers it. So
the reactor.
Yeah, the reactor. So everybody remembers that. It's a part of your childhood. And you can't escape the red tape either. Like the guy who did Total Annihilation, when he was done with that soundtrack and he learned there was going to be a sequel to that game, the studio went to him and said, hey, look, you have talent. We like you. But that first soundtrack you did was the most over the top symphonic soundtrack you've ever heard for a video game. You need to tone it down. And that's the reason why the soundtrack wasn't as good as the first one.
Dude, that Total Annihilation soundtrack was like, it's such a, I hadn't listened to it in a while and I was listening to it fairly recently. And it's like, it's so dramatic. And the game, I guess the game for the time was like, I don't know how much you've seen of that game, but it was pretty vastly ahead of its time in terms of like scale and, just basically like scale. But the soundtrack really took it over the edge because, you know, that was past the point of what you think of when you think of like 90s and 80s video game music. That was very much in the era of like we had CDs and, you know, we had recorded music and games. But that soundtrack really was like on some other shit in terms of bringing like a film score to a game.
Oh, yeah. Check out there's a game called Turrican 2 for Amiga that has a really nasty soundtrack. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. Those games are. I remember playing Turrican a lot through like an emulator as a kid. But yeah, that's I would love to do that where I get to really like imprint my whole kind of vision on a soundtrack. That's like hugely been my. I mean, I think as a music artist, like that's always been my big goal would be to do that. And actually, you mentioned Bust Down, that movie I scored randomly, or not randomly, but so that guy who made that, he was developing a game with a studio. He had me score the game, and so basically I scored an entire game. But the game got shelved in the end. I don't know what exactly happened with the company, but I think they pivoted a bit. It was like a startup. But there is a Ground is Lava scored game that never came out. And I want to do something with the music one day because the music's very cool. But there's probably like 10 or 15 songs I made for a game.
Yeah, because in today's landscape, I don't think you can make like a, I don't know, like a Bomberman Hero game with drum and beat and bass breaks, like the whole soundtrack just being drum and bass breaks. Yeah. I don't even think that would fly today, but it was a great time in the 90s and early 2000s for sure.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, yeah, this game that I did score, like it had a lot of those kind of influences. I mean, that's always, I feel like that's, especially these days with Jungle making such a comeback, that's such a touchstone for so many people is that. That score is really, you know, touched a lot of people, that those Bomberman scores. But I definitely, and hopefully, maybe I'll throw up on Bandcamp or something. But for that game, I definitely referenced that a bit. And there's some of those drum and bass and jungle vibes in the score for that game I did. So maybe one day, now that I think about it, I should throw it up on Bandcamp. That would be fun.
That's awesome, man. You mentioned your brother, and I just wanted to see if maybe there were some parallels because – your brother kind of went a similar route where he had a conscious decision to get away from the confines of business in order to do something that was purely artistic.
Yeah.
You know, for him though, he claims that wasn't the intention though. It was more about entertaining this idea and this concept and people just wanted to collaborate with that. Do you operate the same way? Or when you create a new album, you want as many people to buy it, download it, make as much money as possible. Maybe the process is artistic, but you want the result to be more commercially driven. Where do you land on this?
Barney, my brother, he's really good at,
he's been really successful at having this kind of explosive vision of like aesthetics and kind of concepts. To my detriment as an artist, I think when I first started was when I was most concerned about trying to be likable and market myself. And that first, I think that was a bit of why I had this kind of repulsion from being labeled as this 8-bit artist at the beginning, was because the first record I really did, I don't think I knew there was going to be a listenership. So I really was like trying to package myself as this kind of dialed in aesthetic and artist, more so than I did later. And so that's why the whole album is really cohesive as this kind of 8-bit sort of vibe. Since then, I've never really been as good at branding or kind of maintaining a cohesive like persona or aesthetic. I mean, I would say sonically, I very much have an aesthetic and like a palette of sounds, but I always work in a way where I'm just kind of doing whatever I want and whatever I wanted to make and whatever I want to hear. And I like to think that it comes together in a way that feels cohesive. But I also know that it doesn't really fall into a box very neatly or like, you know, fit into a slot neatly. And I've gone from like in the beginning, like being, I think, doing it kind of naturally to being really, really opposed to it for years and being kind of like anti that part of the whole rat race of being in music. And these days I'm trying to balance that and be more like, do it in a way that's functional, but you know, it's hard for me to ever really like, commit to that kind of self-marketing.
I don't know if I was, maybe, I don't know if I was referring to marketing so much as like your brother also said, trying to cultivate your identity through yourself just seems a little dangerous. And the fact that I can Google you and find out that your name is Jasper, where you went to high school, you went to middle school with.
Oh, you mean like, I see.
Yeah, like who your dad is. Now so I know you live in Mar Vista. I know who that you went to school with, Henry. You know, you're not DJing with a Super Mario head with X'd out eyes and nobody knows who you are type of thing. You know what I mean?
The main thing to realize, I think, with me and with Shlomo and like a lot of these guys that came up with is, I don't think we ever thought possible that we were going to get paid to do any of this when we were getting started. And even like a couple of years into, you know, releasing music publicly, like that this would be a career. Versus when my brother finished college, he got a degree in graphic design. He is like trained and technically skilled in all sorts of disciplines. And I think when he did the Sus Boy thing, he came to it like with a, he had like a persona. He had this anonymous identity. Like he really had this kind of, dialed in like strategy. And I think that for me, like I never knew that I was going to be making money doing any of this stuff. So me being myself was just a given from the beginning, because I was just myself putting music out there, and then trying to monetize that or commercialize that was kind of playing catch up and figuring out how to like recontextualize my, you know, relatively public identity as something that was attached to my musical identity.
When you first hear people like Wiz Khalifa sampling Chrono Trigger, like does that kind of open up like, oh, there is a bigger audience for sampling video game music?
Yeah, I mean like that, I remember hearing that like right when I think that came out. I think it was before.
That was on Kush and OJ.
Yeah, I think that was before I did Cool Party, but I remember I didn't hear it until it was before I released Cool Party, but it was right after I made it. And I was like, oh shit. I was like, this is sick. And I was like, oh, I'm glad it's not the same sample though. But I remember being very hesitant when I made Cool Party. I made it. That was right when like the trap, like the electro, I don't want to say EDM trap because it was, I feel like that was another step, but that was right when like trap beats and like trap or like drums started to kind of get big in electronic music, or not get big, but get big in the, in within a small scene at that point. And when I made Cool Party, I was kind of like, I was just in my room and I was like, I can do that with my sounds. And I don't really sample usually, but I remember for that, I was like, okay, I'm going to use a sample because that's more of like the, if I was going to do like a rap beat or like a, you know, hip hop vibe, I would start with a sample instead. So I picked a sample that was like something that related to me. And then I kind of did the drums in a way that was like, you know, like that style, but with my touch. And that was never something I intended to put out on a record. It was sort of like a, I always made little tracks to play in live shows and DJ sets and stuff. That was very much like a DJ tool I made and something to send around to the homies. But yeah, like as soon as I remember Feel Me was done and getting sent off to mastering, and I sent that to Lior, who was running, or who runs Friends of Friends. And he was like, bro, he's like, this has to be on the record. And I was like, really? And the name Cool Party, like that was like the most, like that, like when you work on stuff, you just, you're like, I got to save it. What am I going to call it? And then just like the first two words that came to my mouth. Because I was like, it was like a party song. And I was just like, it's just like goofy. And I was like, Cool Party. Like clearly is not like a serious title. And it had the like fucking Trolls 2 sample and shit. Like, was a very like serious record for me. Like I feel like that record had the least kind of, my music has a lot of whimsical elements, but that record for me was the most moody thing I've done. And when I put that on there, I was like, I really feel like this is kind of like throwing the vibe off. And you know, it ended up being like my biggest song for like a long time. But looking back now, that music got so much EDM happened and trap EDM and trap electronic music, whatever you want to call it, like that got so much more over the top and like stadium oriented and festival oriented.
Yeah, I blame David Guetta for all that shit that went down, killed it.
I remember playing M83 for friends and then being like, yeah, it's cool, but I don't really like techno. Like everyone called the electronic music techno until like basically until dubstep. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I had friends that would watch like the movie Drive and be like, why is the soundtrack techno? I'm like, oh, I don't know if that's techno.
Exactly. that's not that long ago, you know? And it's so, yeah, I don't know. I think that those genres like trap where they were like repurposing a non-electronic genre into something electronic was like this big stepping stone for that stuff going mainstream, just electronic music in general.
Well, our hour is up, my friend, so I'm going to give you the floor to tell everybody what's on the horizon, so plug away.
Hey, well, that was a good chat, and I appreciate you coming with some random early bits of knowledge. It was cool hearing you shout out College for Dogs. That was like my first official Ground is Lava EP that I always think about putting out, but it's a little rough to fully put my stamp on and put into the world now. Maybe as like a
cassette or something. I'll sell it one day. But yeah, I guess just telling everyone, like, my to whoever's listening that likes my music, and hopefully there's some people listening who maybe will become a new fan. I take a really long time to make records, and this record I currently have, it's all done, actually. It's mastered. It's taken me a few years to make it because I had it one way halfway through, and I ended up basically scrapping it and taking the bones of it and making something new. And it's easily my most involved and ambitious and large scale project I've ever done. It's my longest record, and it's called Puzzle Box. And it's really like my kind of homage to soundtracks and scoring. And, you know, it's been such a big part of my journey as an artist, and my taste as an artist has been about, you know, movie scores and video game scores. Obviously, I've actually just, you know, I don't just do music as Ground as Lava. I do other work. I do a lot of freelance music work, you know, for brands and for, I did music for a movie recently. And I also just, I was actually working in esports production for a while on the side. So I do have a busy life outside of Ground as Lava, but I'm finally, you know, going to put this out soon. And yeah, so expect that early next year, I think. And there's a whole video component I made with a friend of mine. So I'm really stoked to show everyone that. And check out We Did It, my label. And we have a lot of awesome new music we've been putting out. Our newest artist, LST, is making really fucking cool music, and we've all been working on it. And yeah, that's kind of what's going
on. Is it too late to change the album title from Puzzle Box to Cool Party Part 2?
No, but I will say that Puzzle Box is like, you know, it's a concept outside of the movie Hellraiser, but when you hear Puzzle Box, you think of the Puzzle Box in Hellraiser. And I kind of like that.
That's immediately what I thought, yeah.
Yeah, I like, you know, I had an album called Frozen Throne, and like, I didn't name it after the Warcraft expansion, but like, I liked the idea that it was like, it's called that, but it's not about Warcraft. Like, I like that space of like playing with a reference, but repurposing it. And so Puzzle Box, I kind of wanted to do that too, because there's a lot of kind of sounds in the record that are kind of really atmospheric and dark and horror movie influenced. And, but then they made that new Hellraiser movie, which I actually liked a lot, surprisingly. But I was like, dude, if this becomes like a whole new thing, because the new movie really is about the Puzzle Box. I was like, I'm dead ass just going to change the name of the record. Cause I was like, I'm not going to, cause that would have sucked. You know, if like there was this new, you know, the way with movies now, like some movies take off as a meme, like really hard, like It or something.
Morbius.
Yeah. So I was like, if Puzzle Box becomes a meme, I'm going to change the name of the record. But I don't think many people watched that movie. So, or at least talked about it that much. So I'm sticking with the title. Because I've had the title for a few years, and it's the name of the first song on the record too. So, but yeah, that's it. That's my upcoming Ground as Lava weather report.
Right on, man. Thank you so much for being here.
Of course, man. It was great chatting with you.